Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times. Today, we share a conversation with Gina Vale, PhD candidate at King's College London and specialist in gender and radicalisation. Enjoy.
The reason why I became involved in the work that I do, looking at terrorism and extremist violence from a gender perspective, is because I lived in Jordan for a year and a half, Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan in the Middle East. And at that time, between 2012 and 2013, it was women who were discussing Islamic State and the recruitment of their sons, their brothers, their uncles, their cousins, their fathers, their husbands. And it wasn't men that spoke about this. At that time, it wasn't a topic that was spoken about at all within the UK government. And so I found it fascinating looking at the development of women's support networks, even from an early stage, looking at terrorist recruitment. So that's why I have an interest in gender and extremism, in a nutshell.
So interesting. Thank you so much for being here. So can I just really quickly jump into something you said? You said that the women were the ones who were speaking about it, mm-hmm. and the men weren't. Can you kind of break down what it was that they were speaking about and why you think that distinction was there, why the women were talking and the men weren't?
There was no conversation really that was happening between men in educational institutions, libraries, coffee shops, etc., that really captured what was happening over the border. At that time in Iraq, but also in Syria, whereas women were starting to formulate their own informal discussion groups, and this was seen on university campuses, and this was women from the age of 20 and upwards, so my age group too, and it was really them that were starting to push these conversations on why men were joining and what they could actually do to stop it. Particularly for older women and trying to prevent their sons from joining.
Fascinating. So I'm going to circulate, if it's okay, some reports which I read up before this event and that Gina has written and co-authored and so on. But some really interesting stuff that came up there was the place of minors and women in continuing the ideology of IS, mm-hmm. And how that's being overlooked. Could you kind of unpack that for us?
Yes, so if you look at the role that women have played in Islamic State traditionally from the group's kind of descendancy from Al-Qaeda in Iraq through to the present kind of post-territorial phase, you see waves of women's activism and women's ideological commitment that has been misconstrued or misunderstood within foreign policy, but also within press coverage as well, and then the court of public opinion. Mm. At the beginning, you would see women's traditional roles within the home. Women would expect to be supportive wife and eventual mother and procreator for the group. Islamic State sought to create a caliphate, a proto-state entity, and therefore they needed children to become the next generation. Now, however, if you look at the trajectory from around July 2017, not only was Islamic State severely hemorrhaging territory, but they were lacking a literal man power within their ranks. And women you started to see being mobilized and operationalized as suicide operatives, suicide bombers, not driving vehicle-borne explosive devices, but normally wearing explosive vests, and also engaging in frontline combat. And this was something that you saw from around July 2017 right the way through to the fall of Baghouz, which is the last enclave of the caliphate. Now, when you look at their status within the post-territorial internment camps, particularly within Kurdish-controlled northeastern Syria, women are starting to galvanize on the commitment that they have had for the group and start to internalize some of their own ideals that IS put forward. So this idea of nurturing wife and mother on one sense is critical now. There are no men, there are no institutions of schools that are run by Islamic State at least. There are no military training camps for these kids. So women are now taking that front line to fulfill that continuum for the next generation. But most importantly, they are also starting to police their own fellow residents within these camps. So you're starting to see organic activism from these women. Inside these camps, they have started setting up morality policing brigades. This was a continuation from some of the women-led brigades within the Caliphate territory. And in some cases, there have been reports of beheadings, lashings, stonings, and setting fire to other residents' tents, simply for not veiling correctly, for engaging with foreign aid workers, journalists, or lawyers, or simply denouncing their support for the group. So you start to see these variations and these divides now, once we've moved into that second kind of post-territorial phase.
Fascinating. And in your most recent article you shared with me, you're specifying, you're looking particularly into the camps, and you make this the claim about some women kind of taking up the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
But you also specify that some have kind of have lost the ideology or lost
yes.
the kind of belief in IS. Can you tell us about those, that group?
Well, quite simply, if you look at the aims of Islamic State to set up their caliphate, they have lost. Territorially and militarily, they have lost. They were not able to fulfil their promise. However, the ideology, the sense of obstacles going forward to that ultimate goal, this might then be seen as another blip on the radar.
Mm.
So for those more hardline supporters, this is another test of faith. For those who are on the cusp of potentially renouncing their support, this is really a source of disillusionment. They have not been able to fulfil their promise. And now what is left is a decapitation of the group's leadership, the detention of many, if not all, of the serving male fighters and members. And now you have indefinite internment of women and children who are framed as the ones that need protecting, but aren't actually seeking or getting protection either currently from Islamic State or from their countries of origin for foreign recruits.
So you've already touched on kind of how these two groups are being perceived, minors and women, and how, you know, potentially the international response or kind of the policy response has not been ideal. What could be done better and what should be done to kind of to tackle this fact that, you know, there is a threat here, that the ideology will be continued by these groups, however we have, due to kind of gendered reasons, perceptions that colour many policymakers' kind of eye.
I think first and foremost, when it comes to foreign recruits who are currently being held or foreign affiliated members that are being held in these detention camps, repatriation is the first and most urgent priority. Of course, again, this is a controversial, polemical issue. This is open to public debate. Particularly the UK government has been very poor on their response and communicating their response first and foremost. This is not an easy issue to tackle. There are many complexities, not only for those who may or may not meet a threshold of evidence for prosecution. If they don't, how do we go about ensuring that they go through de-radicalisation or rehabilitation programmes? How do you deal with dual nationals, for example? For infants that were born inside Islamic State territory where they are not able legally to inherit the nationality or national identity of their mother, and potentially the father is missing or detained or has been killed, how do you prove that nationality and therefore ensure they have access to education, employment opportunities, etc.? How do you start building those bridges back into society? However, at the moment, inaction is one of the most dangerous actions to take. And what we are seeing is the re-radicalisation or re-indoctrination of women who may or may not be more susceptible to renouncing their support because they are currently being held right next door to those who are hardline supporters, but also because they're losing faith. We are one of the coalition members, the UK government.
Mm-hmm.
We support democratic Western values, yet that's not actually what we are demonstrating with our response. And so at the moment, we're not actually demonstrating that we would be able to provide and uphold the rights, both international human rights and civil rights for our own citizens. In fact, we are stripping citizenship in some cases, and it's counterproductive.
It's a really interesting and so such an important topic. When I read about this stuff, and specifically, obviously, you know, it would be remiss to not point out in the case of Shamima Begum in the UK. Has there been a case example like this where there has been this legal difficulty with citizens who have joined counter-national, you know, not in the interest of a nation's groups, especially underaged, and you know, it strikes me as kind of totally new territory, basically new legal ground, and you know, possibly people who would disagree with repatriating Shamima Begum would argue that, you know, even if we put the laws in place to deal with this new territory of issues legally, in terms of, you know, providing support for de-radicalisation and, you know, finding the evidence for crimes committed to provide a conviction, if that's what they were to pursue, these would not be able to be used in these examples, because you can't apply it retrospectively, mm-hmm. right? So this is a challenge that people consider. How are governments, say the UK government, let's keep it specific to the UK, legally, I'm not sure if you know this is your area, but how legally should they consider these nationals who have joined terrorist organisations and are wanting to return?
The case of Shamima Begum is fascinating for me because she encapsulates so many of the complexities all in one individual.
Right.
And unfortunately, I don't think the UK government has faced such a challenge embodied in one specific profile because of the characteristics that she fulfills. First of all, she is a woman. On account purely of her gender, it is very difficult to try and convict women of any crimes committed on behalf of Islamic State. They were forbidden from appearing in IS propaganda,
right.
which, according to the available data, is one of the only sources that we would have in order to prove someone's active commitment or activism for the group beyond just travelling to join them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing, her gender. The second of all, her age. She has now crossed that adulthood boundary.
Yep.
She went as a minor, she was 15. She did not go in the company of a legal parent, guardian, or over 18-year-old. However, she is now 19. And unfortunately, the way in which her case has been processed is on the account of her now adulthood. However, if we are seeking to retrospectively apply the law, which obviously is not possible,
mm-hmm.
but if we are taking an approach that would consider the fact that she has willingly made that decision to travel to IS territory, she did that as a minor, mm-hmm. not as an adult, which she currently is. She is also a second generation immigrant into the UK. She only holds British citizenship. So the fact that the UK government have stripped her citizenship is illegal. It is against international law to do so. The basis of the claim, or the justification for which, was because, as one of her parents at least is Bangladeshi, she would have rights to apply for Bangladeshi citizenship. However, the Bangladeshi government have made it very clear that if she steps foot in their territory, she would be hanged for terrorism offences. It is very clear that she would have no capability in order to apply for that citizenship. However, the potential possibility of that application has enabled, for the moment, the UK government's decision open to appeal, which is currently going through the courts at the moment. So due to her position, she has been put in a very difficult place where there is no clear-cut answer. Of how to deal with her case upon return, and unfortunately the response that has come back is a very quick fire rejection of, or at least stripping of, her citizenship. So unfortunately her case is not necessarily emblematic of others, but she has fitted into certain categories that would make it very difficult to either prosecute upon her return, and quite frankly, her high profile,
mm-hmm.
which she never, as far as her own social media accounts, something that I have studied, shows, she never actively propagated for Islamic State. She never demonstrated that she would encourage killings of British citizens, for example. She actually kept quite a low profile on her social media accounts before and whilst she was in Islamic State territory. But unfortunately, she was in a way a victim to press coverage which was out of her control, and that has made her such an emblematic case for very hardline action. And of course, we have to consider this with the backdrop of general elections, Brexit,
mm-hmm.
and everything else that goes with it. Making an example or taking a harsh stand has actually had or wielded considerable political power domestically.
Great. One last question from me, and then we can open it up. I know I've really dominated the questions, guys. I just thought it'd be good to get it started. I'd love to hear a little bit about your methodology.
Mm-hmm.
So how have you gone about your research? Can you share that with us?
Yes, so as many PhD students, I'm juggling lots of different projects alongside my thesis. What you will have seen published are such side projects. With regard to the report and papers that Yasmina alluded to, I co-authored a big report which included a global data set of men, women and minors who travelled from 80 countries around the world to join Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and those who have returned to their countries of origin. This entire data set and the corresponding analysis is fully public for you to see. And that was drawn mainly from government reporting, from researchers or research institute published reports, but predominantly government and official intelligence briefings that have contributed to figures for travellers and returnees from these countries. For myself, however, for my own PhD, my PhD is driven entirely through first-hand research with women who have lived under Islamic State rule and have first-hand experience of their governance. What I have done is I've split my PhD into two parts. The first part is a compilation of my own data set of around 700 primary source documents of Islamic State, so whether that's their internal documentation or their external propaganda, that demonstrates their rulings for how they governed women under their rule, and also how their governance had gendered impacts, not necessarily aimed at women, but had secondary impacts that disproportionately affected women. And then the second half of my PhD is based on interviews with women who have lived under their rule, Iraqis, Syrians and Kurds. I'm not interested, ironically, in foreign women who have joined. There has been a lot written about their reasonings for joining the group and why they have travelled, but my interest is specifically in those who whose territory was forcibly occupied and then governed. And they, of course, have the perspective of the precursor to IS and, of course, the subsequent governance of that territory after their withdrawal and collapse. I have travelled to Iraq to do my fieldwork. I spent over a month in IDP camps in northern Iraq, in Kurdish-controlled territory and in disputed territory outside of Mosul, interviewing, so far, 68 women who have lived under Islamic State. I'm also in constant contact with activists, particularly Syrian activists, who are on the ground across Syria, but obviously especially for me in liberated areas from Islamic State, to understand what their continued activism looks like. And I'm also in the process of publishing another co-authored article on women's resistance to extremism in all forms, and another article which is single authored by me on women's resistance to Islamic State themselves. So whether that is protests or any other form of resistance that women conducted under their rule. So that gives kind of a broader remit of my research and how I've gone about it.
Fantastic. So I'm going to open the floor up now. So if anyone's got any questions, please do go for it.
It was a really good talk. So, but I do have two questions. One is that you worked in the Foreign Office before, so, and you also done the research. So how feasible or the de-radicalization programs. Like, I mean, a person ideologically internalized this thing. I understand that organically a person can be changed, but systematically, mechanically, a person can be changed ideologically. That's one question. And the second is that the most of the, as I said, the people who are already radicalized before, and most of the governments, they are not agreeing to repatriate any of the people here because they assume that any of them could be radicalized and they could try to infiltrate the same things here. That was one of the argument people, governments are putting in. How true it is?
Okay, so the first one is mainly the Home Office that deals with de-radicalization programs in the UK, not the Foreign Office. But there are programs such as Channel, which is part of the Prevent strategy, that works on de-radicalization or detecting early warning signs of radicalization and indoctrination of both adults and children. There are different ways in which you can go about it. And in order to understand how you can de-radicalize someone, you need to understand what radicalized them in the first place, and most importantly, their experiences within that group. And that's very different for adults to children and very different for men to women. So for example, if women have an experience of being completely veiled, they want to continue wearing this veil. For example, discrimination within society once they return will be something that could trigger that willingness and want to live a more conservative life, which is not necessarily available within the UK, or at least from their perspective. Quite often for children, it is tangential life opportunities that can provide that distancing. And that's where you get the difference between demobilization and de-radicalization. To try and repurpose someone's energy into having tangible life opportunities that aren't necessarily joining a group, financial incentive is one, to show that someone has education opportunities and that education actually then leads to employment rather than employment post, whether it's school or higher education, is critical. Your second question is about threat upon return. Yes, there will be certainly some individuals who still remain supportive of the group and still wish to do harm to those who are opposed to their way of life and their own beliefs. However, it is the responsibility of each individual state to deal and manage with those individuals, whether that is through threat assessments, whether that is through de-radicalization programs, but it is not the problem of Iraq and Syria to handle and manage British citizens. That's our problem. And if we continue this policy or this approach of inaction that the UK government, for example, at the moment is supporting, what you will get is an increased burden on already overstretched resources within Iraq and Syria. There's limited capacity, and what there is needs to be diverted to their own citizens. And we need to stop this cycle of disenfranchisement and disillusionment and also violence that is still bubbling up. And this feeling of instability and indefinite internment is then going to continue that cycle. So even though it won't necessarily stop the problems for those who are Iraqi and Syrian nationals, it will alleviate some of the burden, and it is the first step in order to try and mitigate the risk coming out of IS-affiliated detainees in the region.
Anybody else got a question?
I'm not sure if I fully understand the mechanism behind women in occupied regions going from passive kind of objects, resources for IS to active purveyors of the ideology. Like, how does that work?
Because women were never passive objects.
Okay.
In fact, IS continually critiqued the Western model of feminism, saying that actually it was failing women and failing men. There were many publications that were produced saying that the fact that women were forced to leave their homes in order to earn a wage, for example, was actually disempowering to women, and it was a distraction from their primary role as wife and mother, which was venerated as the highest symbol of ultra-femininity, the highest symbol of their version of feminism. I'm not going to say jihadi feminism, that's a term that some have used, I don't necessarily agree with it. Whereas if you look now, the transition that has been made, there was a tactical necessity for the involvement of women in combat and operations in order to defend their territory. And what this fits into is a broader picture on offensive versus defensive jihad. And there's a lot that's been written about this. The idea of offensive jihad, expanding territory, there is no necessity for women and children, wonderfully bundled into the same category, to take up arms. However, defensive jihad and this existential threat towards the caliphate, towards the ummah, the global community of Muslims, and of course to the territory which IS themselves were holding, that does not require the permission of a husband or a parent to give permission to a wife or a child in order to take up arms. And so you see this progression through tactical necessity, but also kind of ideological innovations that are allowing women to take up roles that actually the group strategically needs. So it's not necessarily a promotion of women, but it is a repurposing of their roles and a reshifting of their value from one way of contributing to another.
That's really interesting about the offensive defensive jihad. Never really thought about it that way, but fascinating.
Thank you so much. Really interesting. So, I mean, I haven't really studied anything about this, but I was really interested in what you said about the informal networks that the women were building at the start and how they kind of develop, how they transition into more formalized or institutionalized or just different kinds of informal networks, and how, given what's happening in the region, especially in the Kurdish, well, or what used to be Kurdish-controlled regions, how that impacts the way that women are able to communicate with each other and have this sense of support system.
Yeah. I mean, WhatsApp, Facebook, social media is kind of the bread and butter of Syrian activists in particular, women as well. There are activists that I were in touch with, for example, who are illiterate, but they're able to use voice recording on WhatsApp and it's a way to communicate. So there are tools that can involve those who are not necessarily well educated, as well as older women who haven't received an education at all. In terms of formalizing activism, unfortunately with, and I'm not going to go into this too much, but unfortunately with what is happening with the Turkish invasion into parts of Syria, there are some women who are being forced out of their work, arrest of female activists. And what this is creating is, once again, that recession back to informal activism, particularly within the family unit. And often, from my experience, you will find women involving their young children in activism, whether that is donating clothes for internally displaced persons or refugees that need clothes for the winter, whether that is donating food, supplying food to camp populations, for example. So there is that family network that is really starting to build up, and of course neighbours as well within the community. But I want to make it very clear that women are not only activists within the maternal motherhood role. And that's something that I argue against very strongly, this stereotype of women being able to contribute to counter or preventive efforts against violent extremism due to the stereotype that they would have increased access to relatives on behalf of their status as mother, sister, whatever it is, within the family unit. I think that's misguided. It's based on stereotypes, and it's actually restricting women to just the domestic sphere once again, when evidence shows that women are making fantastic progress outside within the public sector.
Can I jump in with a question of my own? How lonely are you in the literature? Like, how are there many academics looking at this? Are there many PhD candidates looking at women's roles, minors' roles? You know, how much is the is academia still in this mentality of mothers and women in the kind of domestic sphere, or is this a growing area?
This is certainly a growing area. The work of non-academic researchers sometimes reinforces stereotypes that academics are trying to battle against. So these stereotypes of women as mothers. And of course, the hunger for innovative policies sometimes within the world of counter-extremism require the engagement of women, and it's often either more simple or easier to resort to stereotypes to do with women's traditional roles within the home. That's often, of course, because quite often preventative strategies or counter strategies are created from a domestic sense, and then trying to transfer that strategy to a country in the Middle East where the culture, society, politics, economy are completely different, gender norms are completely different, religion is completely different, and it doesn't work. In terms of company within academia, there have been certain strides towards this, particularly within the field of women's roles within extremist groups such as Islamic State. There has been a lot of development in that field, less so with children, that is more of a nascent field, ironically, but it's starting. Academics such as myself and others, including Mia Bloom, for example, are making strides in understanding indoctrination and also then the distancing de-radicalisation, I hate using that for children, but the de-radicalisation of minors is certainly an increasing field. But with regards to women's activism, from a societal perspective, looking at the different ways in women actually contribute to preventative or counter efforts, there is very little. And I'm hoping with my colleague that we will be able to publish something that actually provides very rare empirical evidence to demonstrate what women's roles are in counter-extremism beyond the home. And that is our key aim.
Fantastic. Just, you said you don't like using the term de-radicalisation. Why not?
For children.
No.
I argue that children are indoctrinated,
right.
But we have to look at this from the perspective that you are dealing with minors, not adults. In my own research, I tend to subcategorise minors, particularly with regards to Islamic State. So looking at children from the age of 0 to maybe 5 who were infants born inside IS territory, they've played no role within the group beyond being passive citizens. From the age of 4 or 5, however, you start seeing the development of formal indoctrination, not just within the home, within the family unit, but also going to school, and in the case of boys, going to military training camps. And then that kind of cuts off at the age of about 15, where from the data available, you start seeing teenagers travel like Shamima Begum without the company of an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start seeing that increased agency where the push factors into their indoctrination or their radicalization for teenagers may be similar or the same for adults. But up until then, I don't think you can say that a 5-year-old has been radicalized. They've been indoctrinated.
Yeah, very good point. Any other further questions? I'm sure we've got some. I've got many, it's okay. you mentioned in one of your articles that people are focusing a lot on Iraq and Syria and overlooking examples such as, I think you said, the Philippines and Libya. Can you expand on that? I know very little on this.
It's certainly not my area. It's an area that colleagues have looked into. There are experts looking at these particular fields, but for example, in the Philippines, you start to see increased roles of women in propagandizing for Islamic State and actively recruiting. Interestingly, older women, so you start getting this maternal figurehead trying to recruit younger women into what it is to live under the true Sharia, to be modest, conservatively dressed, behave in the most appropriate way, and the place for the fulfillment of those promises would have been Islamic State at that time. In Afghanistan, actually with the dissolution, I suppose you could say, of Islamic State territory from around 2016, you started to see more training camps, particularly for children as well, being set up in Afghanistan, and young cubs of the caliphate camps to try and train children, particularly boys, of course, in military techniques, weapons handling, weapons manufacturing, as well as from frontline combat. And of course, in many cases, that is then complemented with schools to encourage children to sign up for martyrdom operations, suicide operations. Most often for children, it would be vehicle-borne explosive device operations. In Libya, there were certainly a considerable number of women who were actually being recruited, particularly from neighbouring Tunisia. And now, in similar form to what we're seeing in northeastern Syria in Kurdish-controlled camps, now there is a significant number of female detainees that are being held with their children in Libya, waiting for either repatriation or entry into the wheels of justice, which is another interesting angle that I'm sure could be explored by other researchers.
Gosh. And just moving on to the, as you say, separating into minors rather than women and children together.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about indoctrination, not radicalisation, indoctrination, and the strategies that IS used kind of to develop this full generation from, you know, schools to, you know, full institutions, a state.
Mm-hmm.
Could you kind of speak to their strategy and almost kind of how they were so successful in creating this sphere? You speak about it in one of the articles that you authored, specifically kind of in relation to cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And so on.
Yes, there were multiple kind of pathways that IS used in order to indoctrinate and recruit minors within their territory, as well as, of course, foreign children that were either being brought or travelled themselves into the proto-state. What's important to remember is that not necessarily all children have volunteered, whether they are active agents in that decision or not, but particularly in the case of Yazidis, as well as Sunnis, there were forced conscriptions and actually kidnappings of many children. To give you an idea, a third of all of the Yazidis who were kidnapped in Sinjar, so there were 6,800 taken, a third of them were children under the age of 14. So it wasn't just looking at adult women for slavery, also young girls for slavery, but more importantly, young boys for training. And there have actually been propaganda videos that have explicitly featured Yazidi boys conducting executions on behalf of Islamic State. This idea of wielding the power to actually change allegiance and redesign someone's affiliation is particularly strong when it comes to Yazidi minors. Most importantly, as you say, education. So within one academic year, from 2015 to 2016, IS's Ministry of Education that they set up claimed to have educated over 100,000 students, importantly boys and girls, within their territory across 1,350 schools. Now, whether you can verify this claim is another thing. This will go into the PhD, but there has been a lot of competing accounts as to actually how efficient or even existent some of these schools were in practice, in actuality. But they are making obviously bold claims, and given that this is featuring within their propaganda, it would certainly encourage maybe adults to come with their children to be indoctrinated and educated mm-hmm. within their system. One Indonesian teenager, she was 17 years old, she was actually the driving force for the radicalization and then travel of 26 members of her family from Indonesia. And her reasoning was the clearance of family debt to live under the proper Sharia, according to her beliefs. But most importantly, for her to continue education in computer science and for her sister to continue nursing school. And they believed that they would be able to access those services under IS's caliphate. No, of course not. other driving factors and influences are, for example, social interactions and this idea of belonging that IS propagated. So whether that is through events that they held within their territory to try and encourage children to come along, get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Some children would wave a flag, others would be given sweets and pamphlets, others would even be spokespersons if they had good communication skills and public speaking skills. But also importantly in the context of, well, at that time we'd had 3 years of the Syrian civil war, now obviously still ongoing, continued conflict, instability, and of course deaths due to coalition action, for example, the loss of a male role model or an adult or even a breadwinner, quite simply, was another reason why particularly young boys and Iraqis and Syrians would actually look to Islamic State for an income. And they actually paid $100 a month, which was a lot of money.
Mm.
Considering they paid adult fighters around $200 a month, that's showing that this idea of trying to encourage the prematurity, premature maturization of young boys,
absolutely.
This idea of becoming, going from cubs to lions very quickly.
Yeah. Just 2 points on that. First of all, you speak about kind of desensitization in your article,
yes.
And I'd like to, if you could kind of address that in relation to the Yazidi example, because as you say, that's
mm-hmm.
incredibly powerful to wield the power to kind of change allegiance
mm-hmm.
of these children, whether they understood allegiance at that age, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
to be discussed. And then the second point, I mean, the structure is just, it's academic, it's so fascinating how successful, you know, they were in producing this state and creating the sense of belonging, identity, and all these things. I mean, I realise this isn't your area of research, but to what extent was this planned and very much decided,
mm-hmm.
or was it kind of a natural, like naturally came into fruition from the fact that you had a group of people creating a state together? So those 2 points, you know, however you want to address them.
I'll go with the second one first, ironically. Yes. Actually, there have been a lot of leaked internal documents from IS and their primary and highest governing bodies that show this was all pre-planned. But we have to remember that when IS took over territory, they weren't governing barren desert.
Mm-hmm.
There were certainly areas of expansive desert that they were seeking to hold. But what their main aims were governing major cities such as Mosul, Raqqa, etc. And what they did was, even though they tried in some cases to discredit the institutions that were already in place,
mm-hmm.
whether these were regime institutions from Syria, whether these were Iraqi government, what they actually did was just change the leadership system or change the leadership figureheads, for example. So the healthcare system, the quality might have gone down, but you're still using the same hospitals, the same infrastructure. Most often they would try and retain the same doctors, or at least recruit other doctors. They would still use university buildings to conduct courses, but they would restrict the subjects that they didn't feel were aligning with their beliefs or their ideological aims. And so they still had, most importantly, the infrastructure in place. They just changed the personnel in charge. So it wasn't necessarily that this was starting from scratch and pre-planning in that sense, but it was definitely capitalizing on the infrastructure that they already had in place. When it comes to desensitization of children, I actually have an article in the pipeline that specifically focuses on executions conducted by children. There were many on-camera executions conducted by children. Of course, all of them were boys. And some of them, as I said, were Yazidis. Most importantly is this idea of reprogramming children's emotions. So moving from these feelings of guilt and shame and disgust at seeing blood, death, violence, to then actually this becoming normalized as a way of settling disputes, normalization of punishments that would be violent punishment that otherwise would be met with incarceration, now is met with amputation or potentially beheading. This idea that these are now the rightful punishments for certain crimes and that internalization of these ideals. In many cases of early beheadings and public stonings, for example, you would actively have young boys pushed to the front of the audience and forced to watch. And in many of the images and videos, you would see crowds of civilians that unfortunately are corralled into these public execution spots. Often there is a public announcement in advance to say that there will be an execution, and this idea of creating this fanfare and theatre around it. But most importantly, it is always justified and legitimised according to IS's ideology. And this idea that IS never actually conducted what they would see to be superfluous violence.
Mm-hmm.
It was always within the framing of Sharia law or their strict and extreme interpretation thereof. And then once you have children that have witnessed these acts, it's only a matter of time before you start actually encouraging progressive participation of the children themselves in conducting these acts. And what you would have is children starting to throw stones at stonings. You would have children handing out guns or handing out knives to executioners. And then slowly but surely, you would actually have simulated exercises of almost break and entry, killing hostages and prisoners, then to a full on-camera execution one-on-one, where the child takes charge and actually presents the justification to the camera, once again linking it back into the ideology and the kind of Sharia foundation, or their version thereof.
The planning is amazing. Got any questions?
Yeah, I was wondering, sorry, if you could clarify at what ages you start to see this take place. And when we say children, is that all minors? Is this after age of 5 but before 15? Or could you clarify that sort of age range?
The youngest child I've seen conduct an execution was 3. And it goes up from there. Yes.
Sorry. Just a question on the, for example, you mentioned about the Yazidis and the Quds, and they all live in the same region, and the kind of ideology Islamic State follows when it comes to Islamic ideology is different from the Islamic, the way Quds and Yazidi follow. So how does the, when they recruit these people, I know that you mentioned a lot of examples of the radicalization of these people, when it comes to the ideological manipulation, how does that the religious ideology these people follow is not even the same of what Islamic State follow? How does they able to manipulate them and internalize it? Like making sure that they, what you are going to follow is very, what you are following from your childhood is wrong, and what we are following. I'm talking in the perspective of minors and adults in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And they had only 4 or 5 years, not even like decades of rule.
It's showing the idea that any other interpretation falls short of devout worship to God in the right way. This idea of, quite frankly, presenting you're either right or you're wrong, you're with us or you're against us. And if you don't fulfill the requirements, whether that is believing that beheading is the right punishment for apostasy or renouncing faith or criticizing the Prophet or God, for example, if you don't actually believe that that is the right punishment, therefore you are not actually a true Muslim according to Islamic State, because you're not showing you're devout and committed enough to eradicate sin. And this idea of sinful behaviour, even in more moderate approaches, was completely criticised by Islamic State. I think that's probably the best way to describe it. This idea of constantly you're not good enough unless you are actually following the religion according to their interpretation. Anything else falls short.
I had a question which is actually kind of leading on from that one. I know you said it wasn't really what you were, your PhD kind of focuses on, but I was really interested in what you were saying about the kind of recruitment that they did in the Philippines and the role that the women and other people had that was different because of the cultural, obviously it's different from the Middle East. And so I guess my question is kind of how flexible are they in kind of accommodating these different cultural and social structures? And I mean, obviously I'm interested in the role of women within those structures, But I mean, I'm assuming the, you know, the basic ideas that you just said are still very present.
The way in which IS's recruitment function shifted considerably. At first, or consistent within, and still now, the propaganda and documentation that IS produces from its central media outlets is seen to be the only real substance that can be provided for recruitment, for circulation to supporters, for general information about Islamic State. Anything that's coming from the central media office is the only one that can really be trusted. However, at the very beginning, from around 2012, so this is pre-caliphate, but still with IS's engagement and starting of their governance within Syria, from around 2012, you started to see more engagement on social media through supporters and this decentralization of recruitment through influencers, quite frankly. So those who would take IS propaganda, interpret it, and push it out to their own followers. And women played a vital role in this. Most importantly, women who had already made that journey became hugely influential in recruiting others that were considering coming. And it worked in various ways. Most often it would be creating what you would call an echo chamber. And my colleague Charlie Winter has done a fantastic paper about this. He first conceptualizes this echo chamber where you're only considering reading articles, following individual accounts that already confirm your own biases. So that's one, you're shutting off anything that disagrees with your own ideology and your own beliefs. The second is to then link your problems that you're feeling, your individual grievances, with the solutions that are provided within IS propaganda to try and find that connection. And academics have noted that this is called framing theory. The third stage is actually peer-to-peer recruitment. So once you've gone through the stage, you realise that IS provides that solution and you want to join, then you actually reach out to someone that's already made that journey and they can provide the logistical information that you need in order to travel. And that was the way, as I said, my colleague Charlie has theorised it, and I think it's an excellent model to show that progression. And of course, that model could be exported throughout the world. And of course, regional influencers will perhaps have a different approach. Of course, multilingual propaganda pushed out by the group itself enabled recruitment from all across the world. However, with infiltration, even disinformation within IS's own propaganda and infighting, you started to actually see IS clamp down on unofficial propagandists. And around October 2015, women were no longer allowed to communicate with their family members coming out of Islamic State. And around 2016, July, August, there was a complete shutdown on the internet. They would not allow any information coming out.
Many thanks to our speaker, Gina Vale. The wonderful music was by Ashley Lyle-Marsing. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more info on the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound, check out our websites.